Diversity Unit reporting on Newsnight Minnesota is provided by the J. and Rose Phillips Family Foundation, promoting good relations among all races and religions.
We're going to start with some headlines. Just a month after U.S. West agreed to a $37 billion merger with Global Crossing, along comes a hostile suitor. Quest Communications has announced its plans for a $55 billion hostile acquisition of U.S. West, which is Minnesota's largest local phone company. Frontier Corporation would also be involved in the deal. Those are the same two companies that Global Crossing was courting. Either deal would have to pass muster with the Telecommunications Act of 1996. The company selling Jesse Ventura action figures and other products will be allowed to operate as a private corporation and not a political committee. The State Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board's ruling means the company, Ventura for Minnesota, Inc., will not have to report what it earns or how it spends its money. Newsnight's Mary LaHammer reports.
New from the Reform Party. The new Jesse Ventura action figure.
The concept born in a campaign commercial can continue to be a commercial product.
Somewhat naive and formalistic to think that VMI is not political simply because VMI says it is not.
Despite concerns from the public advocacy group Common Cause, the Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board gave Ventura for Minnesota Inc., or VMI, the go-ahead to operate as a nonprofit corporation.
Any proceeds that VMI receives will be charitable and educational.
Okay. Always.
Yeah, there's no money that's going to go into the campaign.
Another question? Three of the campaign finance board members were recently appointed by the governor, including Ventura advisor Tim Penny.
The staff issued this report and recommendation some months ago. Nothing has happened in the ensuing time period to change that basic recommendation. No new member on this board has had any influence on this report.
And I think I can act impartial.
Common Cause wanted the new appointees to abstain from voting, but only Tom Heffelfinger recused himself because of legal work he's done for VMI.
I think there's a significant distinction between being appointed by a governor and perhaps politically supporting that governor and the position in which I found myself. My partner was actually involved in the initial establishment of VMI.
Permitting the governor to appoint of the majority of this board while asking permission for it to sell Jesse Ventura dolls is like letting the foxes determine who will guard the chickens.
This is all new territory for everybody. And any time that you have new territory, you're going to have some people have differences of opinion.
Regardless of today's advisory opinion, allowing the sale of Jesse Ventura action figures, the boxes will change. When the new shipment arrives in July, it will no longer say Jesse Ventura for governor, but it will read Jesse Ventura the governor. At the Capitol, I'm Mary LaHammer for Newsnight Minnesota.
Common Cause says today's ruling will create a large loophole in campaign spending limits. Ventura for Minnesota says proceeds will not benefit the governor because the money's going to several charities to be named in a couple of weeks. Dr. Stephen Miles announced today that his campaign for the U.S. Senate will focus on affordable health care, access to higher education, and saving Social Security. Miles is vying for the DFL endorsement to run against Senator Rod Graham.
I think there are several things that set me apart. First off, there are very few physicians, senior experts, and scientists in the U.S. Senate. There are a lot of lawyers. And I really, truly believe that part of the concept of a citizen legislature is to draw on the breadth of skills that are present in the citizenry.
Miles's declared DFL opposition includes David Lillehaug and perennial candidate Dick Franson. An election in Washington County tomorrow will decide what's going to happen to two small communities. Lake Elmo and Bayport voters will be asked whether they want to merge. The new town would be called Lake Elmo. Some hope that this would keep neighboring towns like Oak Park Heights from grabbing up their land. A low voter turnout is expected. Fans of Bob Dylan are floating plans to build an innovative Bob Dylan Digital Art Center on the Duluth waterfront. Dylan was born in Duluth and grew up in Hibbing. The Dylan Museum would feature the artist's songs and paintings as well as interactive media. Beyond that, organizers are short on specifics, but they say that the time is ripe for the prophet Dylan to be honored in his hometown. And those are the headlines. At this point, the prophet would say something like, "You know, something's happening, but you don't know what it is." Well, that's why we have the Citizens Forum coming right up. Welcome, I'm Ken Stone with Newsnight Minnesota.
And I'm Martin Costi with Minnesota Public Radio.
For the next hour, citizens from around the state will join Governor Jesse Ventura to talk about the problems facing Minnesota's farmers and those who depend on them. It is the latest in a joint venture with KTCA, the Star Tribune newspaper, and Minnesota Public Radio. Tonight's program is the first of four this summer, which will focus on Minnesota agriculture. Governor Ventura is our guest, as our State Agriculture Commissioner, Jean Yogeson, and Farm Services Agency State Director, Tracy Beckman.
A number of groups will help us question this trio tonight. County Extension agents all around the state have convened discussion groups to watch this show. Nearly 50 gatherings in nearly 50 counties.
We're going to hear from two of them live tonight via video conference technology. Howard Pearson is with a group of citizens in Crookston, Minnesota. And Erlen Wienes will be joining us from the Ag Extension office in Worthington. Also here in the KTCA studio, Lori Sturdivant with the Star Tribune is with a group of 100 citizens chosen as part of a random statewide poll. Okay, on with the show. Going to start with a question to you, Governor. You're a big believer in the freedom of the marketplace and less government is better. What role does government have in agriculture and specifically state government?
Well, government has to play a role, I think, today in agriculture because, and in more than state government even, because, you know, farmers have the ability to go out and raise crops and do all that, but it's gotten beyond that now. To be a farmer today, you almost need 3 or 4 degrees. You need a degree in economics, a degree in marketing, a degree in this, that, not just planting in the soil anymore, raising a crop and taking it to a marketplace and selling it, because we're so dependent on the global economy today. Worldwide, and you know, the federal government sets many farm prices, and I think our role in state government is to work as hard as we can to ensure that our farmers have a level playing field, because I believe in them, and I believe that given a level playing field, they will go out, they will prosper, and they will do their jobs, which is to grow crops and feed the world. And I say feed the world today because that's what it is today. But you know, you've got silos, excuse me, I have notes. I'm a city kid. But even a city guy like me knows when the farmer's in trouble, you know, and you go out. But we have to work with our farmers, allow them to diversify, allow them to get to where they don't rely on just one or two specific crops anymore. Because if those markets go bad, then they're left in trouble. And we've got to look for long-range solutions, because I know this year, I think it was about $133 million this year alone we've had to use to help bail out the farmers. We can't face doing that year in and year out. It's just not going to be available to do it.
Governor, you've prided yourself all along as being a real believer in the free market, in the fit survive. Does that apply to farming, or is agriculture somehow different from, say, manufacturing?
I think it applies, but farming is put under so many stipulations. You have environment stipulations. You have the federal government controlling and stipulating like that. It is not just a simple grow your crop and sell it, take it down to the farmer's market, put it out there and sell it today. It is so confusing. I had meetings with Commissioner Hugeson last week, and at the end of them, I looked at him like I'd gone through an advanced physics course. You know, when you start having to figure out this equation, that equation, what it's selling for here, if you can sell it on the backside and make a deal with Hormel at this point, and then the price will go up or go down and all of that. And it's very, very complicated today for the farmer.
All right, let's go to some questions from the citizens. We're going to go to Lori Sturdivant first, right here in the studio.
Hi, Governor and Commissioners. We have had a discussion now since about 5 o'clock this afternoon with 85 people here in the studio audience, and we put some questions to these folks. There's universal concern about the distress in rural Minnesota today, but there's some considerable disagreement here about some possible solutions. We asked this group, should more tax money be spent to improve economic conditions for Minnesota farmers? Only about a quarter of those here said yes, and a good quarter also said no pretty firmly, with the rest of the group undecided. But more than half of this group is willing to spend a little more for their groceries if that increase were to somehow support family-oriented farming or to allow more Minnesota-grown food to be on shelves. We have a citizen here with our first question tonight.
My name is Heidi Vlasic, and I'm from Oakdale, Minnesota, and I work at a medical manufacturing firm in the Twin Cities. I want to ask, farming is both a way of life, a valuable part of our cultural history, and it's a business industry. We combine both aspects in a government support and policy for farming, but this has obviously not worked. Are there ways to support maintaining the cultural value of family farming without tampering with free market forces of supply and price?
Let's go to the Ag Commissioner for that one.
She knew better than me.
First of all, when you look at what is a family farmer, you're going to have a lot of differences in opinions among people today, because there is a very wide range. You can have a traditional family farm where you think of mom and dad and the kids. You could have an extended family, which might include five or six different families that are all knit together, and they're going to operate differently. I think what we're going through right now out in rural Minnesota, rural America, is not... It's really more untypical than usual. The economic problems that we're having because of the Asian problem, the decline in the markets out there that's caused low prices, the fact that we've got a large surplus now, the weather has been good. We're in a situation that's really not normal. But given that not being the case, we still have a lot of pressures out there that would mean that the family farm that we've maybe, like we've seen it before, is under pressure in ways today that never has been in times past. So there are going to be some changes. Can it survive? I think it can. But it's not going to necessarily be done the same way that it was 20, 30 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago. But you look at the business you're in, I'm sure isn't the same today as it was 10 years ago either. And so some of those same forces that are driving the mergers that are going on in all kinds of industries are some of the same pressures that's coming to bear now. It used to be that farmers, by working hard, could be successful. Those days aren't necessarily there anymore. Now it's a case of what happens in Beijing or Brussels or some of those other places has a real impact on what happens to the farmers in Minnesota. That makes it very difficult to try to cope with that kind of a situation.
Let's go down to Erlen Wienes. He's down in Worthington.
Yes. This is Carolyn Penning, and I am a farm wife from Wilmot, Minnesota. Erlen doesn't want to talk. on the two questions that you asked, should more tax money be spent to improve agricultural conditions? 32% of us said yes. On the second question, would we be willing to pay more for food? 88% in the Worthington group said yes. And following that line, I would like to ask this question. A generation ago, the American consumer paid 45 to 50% of their income for food. And now the consumer pays 10 to 12% of their income for food. Would it be possible to put in place a tax on food that all people would pay at the store, and that this tax could be used solely to subsidize this revenue assurance program to help us with our premiums for our crop insurance and that kind of thing, so that if we had a bad year, crop-wise, weather-wise, whatever, price-wise, that this would help us out so that we wouldn't be doing what we're doing now, suffering, I mean, not making any money at all?
Tracy Beckman, that sounds like a federal question.
Yeah, and thank you, Carolyn, for that question, because I think it speaks to what public debate is all about, where we're looking at ways of finding solutions to the problems we have. And the problem I see with whatever you use for funding, if we don't make a decision that we want to keep farmers out on the farm, it really doesn't matter how much money you generate. If the will isn't there, and if ideologically we have not made the decision that we need farmers and that we need to maintain for a social part of society, then it doesn't matter how much money you throw at agriculture. You're not going to save the family farm.
Mr. Beckman, your answer seems to imply that we have maybe not made that decision, that we need small farmers, family farmers.
Oh, I think the decision's been clear. Freedom to farm was clear. The policy was set that we were going to back away from farmers and away from the network of support that we'd put in place over the years. To me, it couldn't be any clearer than that. The congressional delegation, Paul Wellstone, David Mingy, and Colin Peterson all spoke against freedom to farm to start with, voted against it. They warned that this would happen, and the fact is we have set American farmers up. by the policy that's come out of Congress.
But, Mr. Beckman, you know that a number of, as a matter of fact, the majority of American farmers, when asked, do you want the federal government to get out of agriculture, will say, if they just leave us alone, we'll do okay.
Well, you hear that. You know, and I think what Freedom to Farm, farmers are proud people that want to see the federal government get out of their business, want to see markets work. But the reality is the Europeans spent $9 billion subsidizing their farmers at a time when they sat down and negotiated trade agreements with us. These folks have gone hungry in Europe. They're going to protect their farmers. They're not going to let their base of agriculture disappear. That's what we're asking American farmers to compete in. And they can't compete against the subsidies that the other countries are willing to put forth.
Well, but there's still things that can be done. I mean, if we take a look today at the dairy farms, they are operating under a 50-year-old premise, and this even made me amazed, this Eau Claire deal, where they're paid according to how close you are to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. What does that have to do with anything? And if we're going to stick with picking a spot, let's take Beaumont, Texas. You know, that way at least it'll be fair. And you've got unfair practices happening right inside our own United States, because in the dairy industry with this Eau Claire, where they're paid that way, well, you've got the heavy lobbyists of the New York farming industry, heavy lobbyists of the California industry, and they're, of course, going to stick with the Eau Claire. And here you have Wisconsin. On the license plate, it says the nation's dairy land. And we're losing one, you know, vast number of dairy farms because of our own internal policies that cause for a horrible, unfair advantage for the coasts. And here in Midwestern America, the Farm Belt of America, they're getting the short end of the stick.
Speaking of the Farm Belt, I would like to get to Crookston. Howard, a person is right there in Crookston. Howard, can you hear us?
Yes.
Fire away.
In questioning the group if they would be willing to spend more for food to support Minnesota farmers or Minnesota-produced food, the vast majority of the group said they would be, provided that money goes directly to the farmer. And we'll have Carolyn Weber ask the first question.
Good evening. I wasn't sure if I would... my name is Carolyn Weber. And I wasn't quite sure if I would dare go with this, but I thought I might say, Governor Ventura, we'll have to stop meeting like this. You may not remember, but I asked you a question during the debate on October 30th, and I'm going to ask it again. You talked about a level playing field. I asked what your vision was for agriculture in the northwest sector of the state, for people who were transitioning out of farming, and for those who chose to stay. So I'm wondering, how do you choose to or propose to create that level playing field?
Well, I propose to help create it by heading to Washington in about 2 weeks and testifying in front of Congress out there to let them know that the playing field is unlevel, and that since so much of farming is based upon federal rules and federal regulations, that it's time they take action out on the federal level to ensure that our farmers here in the Midwest get the fair playing field. As I just spoke about in the dairy industry, it's utterly ridiculous because the feds subsidize according to how close you are to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And I don't understand that. What does Eau Claire, Wisconsin have to do with the price of milk? You know, whether it's created here or New York or California, it should all be done in a more fair basis. So, and I'm also putting together a task force with my five top commissioners, Commissioner Hugeson, as well as Trade and Economic Development, and I got to find it here in my note, Revenue, DTED, and Finance and Commerce, and we're going to do the best job we can, because we've put farming very high on the list or the agenda, if you want to call it that, here in Minnesota. Because let me put it to you this way: if the family farmer falls, so will Greater Minnesota. Because it has a trickle-down ripple effect. You know, if the farmer goes under, that means he doesn't buy a car from the local car store. It means he doesn't frequent the hardware store. And you're going to see rural or Greater Minnesota take the tumble if we allow the family farmer to fall.
We have a follow-up question from Crookston.
I thank you for putting farming there on your agenda. And also, for the farmer that has transitioned, I know that at the federal level, there is an offer and compromise for federal taxes for people who have transitioned out of farming. And I'm wondering, is the Minnesota Department of Revenue developing forms on which to submit offers in compromise for state taxes?
I can't answer that now, but I know Matt Smith, my commissioner of revenue, is you know, he's looking at a variety of tax issues here in Minnesota, property taxes, as well as taxes helping the farmers also. And you know, that's the focus now. The legislature's out of session, so we can get back to work now and do what we need to do from an administrative end.
Governor Mature, to follow up on your remarks about going to Washington about a week and a half, 2 weeks, I think, from now, when you're there, you say you're going to argue, you're going to testify for the level playing field, for a fair shot for Midwestern farmers, but if that's not possible, I mean, we're dealing with questions that are, you know, of overseas trade, subsidized European farmers, as Mr. Beckman mentioned. If that ultimately isn't possible to level that playing field, do you support some sort of a scheme in which the federal government props up farming, especially, you know, family farming, with some sort of a tax or something like that?
Well, I'm never for raising taxes if I can help it. You know, certainly as a last alternative, I suppose you'd have to look at every alternative to solve the problem, and you know, maybe elimination somehow or controlling the middleman, you know, might be something in there. You know, if you look at the price the farmer gets and the price you, the consumer, buy at, there's quite a difference in there.
Something the federal government could do, perhaps, to intervene and
whatever they can do, because as I said, it's going to be a trickle-down effect, and it's going to be a massive one if the family farmers in greater Minnesota start falling. It's going to have an effect on every part of greater Minnesota.
And part of what our focus is to try to help the farmer get some of that middle income that right now they're losing. And so that I think is part of the state's goal too, as it relates to addressing that particular issue.
But then again too, if I could add, the family farmer is going to have to learn to be flexible too, because as Commissioner Hugesson said at the start, the times, and if you want to imitate your friend Bob Dylan, the times, they are changing. and the times are changing. And so, you know, farmers are very independent people. You know, your average family farmer, if he gets stuck in the ditch, he'll spend all afternoon getting himself out rather than, you know, going two doors down and asking for some help, you know, and that type, because that's the nature of the independence of being a farmer. And I think they're going to have to get flexible and start going together with their neighbors and co-oping and finding ways to succeed. I was just at a hog farm down in Hastings, where 20 farmers have gotten together and are now dealing directly with Hormel in the raising of hogs, and they're buying in large, massive hog markets where they can get top dollar and top price for their hogs and get it locked in so that it doesn't fluctuate as the market fluctuates so much. So they're going to have to be able to move too a little bit here and be flexible.
Let's go on over to Lori.
Hello, my name is Joanne Pels, and I'm from Walker, Minnesota, and I'm a business rep for the State Employees Union. My question is more in the flexibility field or the transition, and your research departments. Have they looked at what are we importing, and can we build that here, and what are the other alternatives that farmers can do with their crops? We're talking about having 30 to 45% surpluses throughout the whole United States. That means there's got to be something that we can make that's not being made.
There are numerous things that are being done in research right now. University of Minnesota, of course, ARI, Ag Utilization Research Institute. Various commodity groups are involved with activities. I was just part of a event this spring having to do with soy diesel being used to burn in Hennepin County vehicles. So there's numerous ways in which we're looking at trying to use ag products. So it becomes a situation of getting the research dollars with which to do some of that, being able to try out some new ideas. They're looking at using corn starch, for instance, to be able to use for de-icer types of material. If in fact we could get to the point where we could use that on our highways instead of salt, it becomes a very win-win kind of situation. Not only do you do away with the corrosion that comes from salt, but you're using a biodegradable detergent type of activity that will clean away the ice. They can use it on airplanes too, in the sense of doing that. So there's numerous things that are out on the horizon that I think, as we keep working with it, offer some new opportunities. We're using products today that 10, 15 years ago they never would have thought of using for ag products.
All right, let's go to Worthington and have another question there.
Good evening, Governor.
Good evening.
My name is Jim Jones. You were at my house here this spring.
Hi, Jim. How are you?
Remember being at my house, Governor?
Yes, I do. How are you doing?
Pretty good.
Good.
We're still in the same old fix. We still haven't had a paycheck yet. My question is more for Commissioner Gene Hugesson. I'd like to know his opinion on where he thinks the mid to small size family farm is headed. I'm talking about a farm that generates $150,000 to $300,000 of gross revenue. And does he think there is a place in Minnesota for these farms, or should these small farms quit and do something else?
No, I definitely think there's a place in Minnesota, in fact, all agriculture for small to medium size. But as the governor mentioned before, there's got to be the willingness and the ability to be flexible, because somebody with 160 acres with a few head of livestock isn't necessarily going to be able to farm the way their parents and grandparents did in previous generations. Now it may involve one or both of the spouses having some outside income for some a cushion to rely on. It may be diversifying into some new crops that we haven't used before, because this offers some opportunities to spread that risk. It might mean going into together with some kind of a venture with their neighbors, such as the governor described this farm that we were on last Friday, 160 acres, fairly close to the Twin Cities, yet he's able to keep things together because he's doing things, again, differently than what he had done some time ago. So I think it can be done. But it's not necessarily going to be somebody coming in and saying, okay, this is the way you have to do it. Rather, it's going to be a case of people being innovative, government working where they can help to provide some of those new ideas, and making sure that these people have access to, in some cases, might be some niche marketing kinds of things, being able to sell direct to some consumers. We started a state meat inspection program now that's given some opportunities for people to do some of these things that's looking quite successful as well.
Commissioner, forgive me, but it mm-hmm. does sound as though what you're saying is the small family farm can survive in Minnesota as long as it's willing to become a corporate farm.
Oh, no.
So you're talking about associations between, but you know,
what is a corporate farm? I mean, a corporate farm is, we have some small family operations that are corporations because they've incorporated to be for tax purposes, whatever. We've got some large, huge conglomerates that are family farms. So, I mean, the term doesn't really mean a whole lot when you're looking at what's going on out there in agriculture. Murphy Farms is a family farm, and yet it's one of the largest livestock hog operations in the whole United States.
Mr. Beckman?
Yeah. I've only been director of the Farm Service Agency for 3 months, and in that time period, we've worked with a number of farmers. The Farm Service Agency is the lender that works with trying to maintain people at a small scale in agriculture. That's our mission. At $1.70 corn, there is no way even the big people are going to survive. So as far as talking about family sizes and so forth, there's virtually no one out there who can make it with the existing markets. I don't care how efficient you are. I don't care how good a marketer you are. If you're going to market for a loss, you're only going to be there so long. That's where we're at. All this other stuff is nice to hear. But the fact is that the existing policy we have does not make it possible for a farmer on crops to make it, period. That's where we're at.
All right, let's go up to Crookston for another question.
I'm Sandy Peterson from Crookston. My question kind of goes back to the research and development aspect of the industry. We've seen a lot of value-added industries developed in the area and show some potential and then occasionally get eaten up or snapped up by a large conglomerate. What kinds of protections can be put in place to prevent that from happening, or at least make it possible for those industries to have a chance at being developed?
Yeah, I'd like to take that. I visited with Paul Wellstone a couple of times today. He would have liked to have been here tonight because he's been following this issue of who's processing our products. And I agree with him that until we get serious about challenging and breaking up some of these big conglomerates, we're simply not going to see our
our agriculture in Minnesota flourish. It's gotten in the hands of just a few people, and basically they're controlling the markets, and it's sending a false signal in the marketplace. And until we get serious about breaking that up, I'm afraid we're in for a long-term low prices.
But that's an argument that people could make about the telecommunications industry, about the media, I mean, mergers. We just had a headline not too long ago about U.S. West. It's happening in every industry, so why is farming so special?
Well, I think, and I don't know about the rest of the industry, but there are about three or four major producers or processors of our meat in this country, of our red meat. Now, does that seem right? And farmers then are the benefactors of this with 8-cent hogs? At a time when corporations are showing record profits, and at a time when farmers are going broke. It just doesn't make sense to me that this is the people that are serving our farmers best. And I think we have to start speaking out against this.
Governor, you mentioned that you've been going to school on agriculture policy lately. Any thoughts right now about the size of some of the agribusiness conglomerates? And
well, again, like you said, you know, it's part of we live in a very Darwinian world in many ways in business, where the large eats the small, and it happens. The merger of Honeywell that just took place. The one company was slightly larger than Honeywell, so we now lose our corporate headquarters here in Minnesota. I think a thing, like Commissioner Hugeson talked about, we've got ways that I think we can, you know, as many as people complain about ethanol and all of this, well, look at it this way. If we subsidize ethanol somewhat here in the United States, does it not make us less dependent then upon foreign oil? And what does it cost us to keep our troops over in the Middle East, to keep carriers there, all our military, to keep its hand on that spigot of oil over there? So you have to make a judgment call there. I'm very pleased that we got on the ag bill this year industrial hemp, because you have hemp in Canada now being used for everything, manufacturing clothing, paper products, all the products that come from hemp. And where is it going? It's coming right across the border, those products being sold here. Now, there's no reason why our farmers shouldn't have the ability to grow hemp also and produce an alternative product out there, which makes them less, you know, makes them much more competitive out in the open market on many different products than not just simply producing food. They can get bad parts of their land, grow hemp, and still end up making profits off that, and it creates a whole new industry here in the United States. You then have to market all of that. You have to manufacture it. You have to truck it, and creates more jobs all the way across the board.
Laura, you have another question over there.
Yes, I do.
Well, I don't know if this is a question. This is Duke Hust. I own a farm in Fillmore County, and I own a bed and breakfast down there, and I also have a job here in the Twin Cities. But on the level playing field, and the Commissioner and Tracy, you could answer this possibly, one of the things that the Freedom to Farm Act prohibits is a farmer from growing vegetables. I'm sure that was the bill to pay the California delegation to vote yes for the farm bill, but that's something that we could work on our congressional delegation to get reduced. Another suggestion would be to make certain that the state institutions purchase locally. I mean, you talk about the conglomerates doing most of the meat processing. Do we buy for our prisons and our state institutions from local producers? I don't know, but I'm hoping that you look into it. And the other one is, yet I look as I drive down along the Mississippi River, the most gorgeous apple country I've ever seen, and we every time I buy an apple in the store, it says Washington State or Chile or New Zealand. Yeah, why don't we grow more apples in Minnesota? Those are the kind of things you ask the Commissioner of Agriculture questions, and he says, "Well, we're working on new products for soybeans or new product for corn." Find new products, not new products for the old crops.
But now, I think you raised a very valid point about what you find in the grocery stores. But it's important that you, as consumers, ask that grocer, where are the Minnesota apples? Because that's what, you know, that's what determines what that grocer is going to carry.
Yeah, but we don't produce enough apples in Minnesota to feed us. I mean, you can't buy, there are more apples bought in Minnesota than are grown in Minnesota. And it should be the other way around.
We have a program called Minnesota Grown, in which we feature and promote Minnesota raised products, and they have stickers which they have on there. That's the kinds of things though that the consumers can be doing there to increase that awareness and that demand for those products.
But why don't state institutions, why don't you require the state institutions to purchase those products, those Minnesota products?
Because I think at this point the legislature has determined that wanting to have the lowest bid for something is more important than having Minnesota products, and I'm not defending it, but I think that's exactly what's happening.
Governor?
You to me.
Do it.
You know, hey, I'll be happy to look into it. Made in Minnesota. Works for me.
All right, there you go. Let's head on down to Worthington.
I think we just made some news. I'm not sure.
I think we did. Worthington?
Yes, my name is Terry Perkins, and I'm a farm partner in Worthington here, just north of town. I'd like to thank the Citizens Forum for offering this opportunity and also talk a little bit about something we're talking about by extension, and that is the rural communities and the rural lifestyle, but more so the businesses and that are affected by farming and everything else in the community. One of the figures that has been toted about is the effect of the multiplier effect of the ag dollar. For each ag dollar that you have, it turns over 5 to 7 times nationally. Many of you people in the audience know that. And it turns over about 3 times locally. And most of that now is taken up in costs for those of us in production agriculture. And so I might say that $4 per acre property tax relief was helpful to us, but we'd like to thank you for that. And the demographics of rural areas and the age of farmers, as well as the age of our rural business people, is really alarmingly high, and to get new people started being in farming or in small business is very difficult. So business and rural communities are intertwined, as we've been talking. One of the questions that I have is whether you would be willing to support with state and or federal tax dollars small business and rural community relief, such as help for telecommunications, which is going to be so important in the future, and ways for new businesses to get started in our rural areas that are not only dependent on agriculture, but perhaps enhance agriculture, and agriculture could enhance them. Thank you.
Governor, state aid for non-agricultural businesses but targeted to rural Minnesota because agriculture is in such severe straits.
Well, we have to look at everything, but again, and I'll always repeat what I've said hundreds of times before, whenever we take a dollar to give it to somebody, we didn't create it as government. We took that dollar from someone else. So anytime you're subsidizing someone, you had to take that from someone else to subsidize this person. So you walk a fine line there, you know, of turning what, Greater Minnesota into an entire subsidized existence. I don't think that's necessarily the answer that we need to look for. I think that we can be innovative. We can come up. I think if you get people working here at the local level, at the state level, and certainly at the federal level, I think that there's got to be something out there other than just straight subsidizing, because that's a slippery slope to fall down.
Governor, on a basic question of basic values here, if you look down the road 30 years, year 2030, and you see a state of Minnesota in which 95% of the people live in the Twin Cities. Is that a gloomy prospect, and is that worth spending a lot of money to avoid?
Well, you know what's funny? It's a catch-22, because on the other hand, all I hear about is urban sprawl. You know, that we're sprawling out. So what is really happening here? I'm not sure. You know, Gene, if you'd like to jump in on it.
You know, I think that's kind of really where the key comes down to there is where does government spend its money and spend it most wisely? Because certainly if you have a mass migration to the Twin Cities area, whether it's 7 counties, whether it's 15 counties or 20 counties, all surrounding the St. Cloud to Rochester area, whatever, if in fact we're spending all kinds of money to create a new infrastructure while another infrastructure is going on unused, that's not good use of government resources either. So I think where government has to make that decision is how do we in fact do with the most prudent spending of our money, revitalize, enhance the rural areas so that people can stay in rural Minnesota and still have a good quality of life, at the same time of not having to build new schools on the fourth and fifth ring suburbs.
Sounds like an argument for what the questioner was asking for.
Well, I think it's something that needs to be looked at, but you look at just handing people some money and thinking that's going to solve the problems. I think you've got to be looking at it in such a way as how do you most wisely do something
that's going to... And if you're subsidizing so heavily out there, isn't that going to increase the sprawl to go out there?
I don't think any suburb goes quite that
well,
far.
But the point is that, you know, everyone, it's a funny situation. Everyone in the city wants to live in the country, and now you're telling me everyone in the country could end up in the city.
That does raise an issue. The average age of a Minnesota farmer, I think, is around 58, 59, something like that. And you hear a lot of talk about the sons and the daughters aren't going to farm. They don't want to farm. They can't afford to farm. Is there anything that the state or federal government can do, and should there be anything they do, to target help to young startup farmers?
Well, I think you look at not only starting young startup farmers, but also help for rural communities so that there's jobs off the farm in those rural communities as well. Not only for the farmer, but for the spouse, or for a way to have a dynamic community in these rural areas that aren't totally dependent on agriculture. That's one of the dilemmas that we've got out there right now in rural Minnesota. We've tried some beginning farmer programs before, and they can work if they're done carefully, but we've also had some real disasters of some programs that haven't worked either. So it's got to be done right.
All right, let's head to Crookston. We have another question up there.
My name is Sarah Lagos. I'm from St. Paul, and I work at the Glenwood-Lindale Community Center. This question is just directed to whoever can answer it, but I want to mention first that many of us, when we hear a farmer being subsidized with millions of dollars, we start wondering why it is that we also hear farmers saying that they're going broke. Now, my understanding is, at least the governor mentioned, that the farmer's not earning that much money and the consumer is paying a lot of money. So if the farmer's the loser and the consumer is paying a lot, who's the winner? And in addition to that, what can be done to sort of close that gap so that the farmer can appreciate some of that middle money, and so that the consumer can also benefit from maybe not having to pay so much? There seems to be something missing in the equation.
Let me just... I saw in the paper, I think it was last week, General Mills raised the price of Wheaties by a certain percentage. And they said they had to have this in order to generate $60 million more to keep their profits up. At the same time, what farmers were getting for their corn was 40 cents below what they could stay in business. In other words, $1.70 a bushel. You have to ask yourself, if the farmer's getting less and they raised the price of the Wheaties, who's getting the money? It's pretty obvious to me that the middle person, and they're showing the record profits right now. So to me, it's pretty obvious where the dollars are going.
But are the people manufacturing Wheaties benefiting from the subsidies we're pouring into farming, or used to pour into, I guess, because we don't really...
You could argue they're getting the cheap grain. And that they, in fact, are the benefactors, that the Cargills and the Continentals and the larger ag interests are the ones who are benefiting from the lower prices.
Governor, do you believe in the sense that the large companies are ultimately to blame? You hear that a lot in rural Minnesota.
I think that there, any time you start cutting down the amount of competition, that has a direct effect on prices later on. And I think I'm a firm believer that more competition is good. The more competition you can have creates that much more alternatives for people to thrive out there. So it's a very Darwinian business climate we live in today, of the large eating the small. And if there's a mechanism we can do to get away from that, I think we ought to try to pursue it.
When you testify in Washington in 2 weeks, would you say something along the lines of, we need an antitrust?
I don't know if it falls under antitrust. I'm not sure if it would fall under that. If it's monopolizing, then certainly it should be looked at, because monopolies are against the law. And if it's getting to that point, I don't know if it is yet or not. There's still what determines a monopoly? Two competitors, four, six? At what point is that determined? I'm not a lawyer, so I don't have an answer as to what they would determine as being a monopoly.
I think it's very encouraging, Governor, that you're willing to look at it.
I mean, and question what's going on in the marketplace right now, because to me it's obvious it's not working. And so the fact that you're open to questioning it, I think, is a very positive thing.
And the example you give me, it's. I mean, if the farmers are getting an all-time low for their product, and yet the buyers are paying an all-time high for the product,
you go out there and tag up with Paul Wellstone, and I guarantee you, you'll move some things in Washington. Between the two of you...
I don't know if I want to go quite that far.
Well... Just move a little.
That's a tag team I want to see. Let's go to Lori. She's got another question with the citizen.
Here we go. Hi, I'm Mary Stearns. I'm from Eagan, and I'm a stay-at-home mom. Governor Ventura, regarding organic farming, I realize you've recently signed a bill to support the organic farmers in Minnesota, and for that I want to thank you. What do you see as a future in organic farming?
Well, again, I, in many cases, I don't see it as a full livelihood necessarily, because organic or non-organic, there's trouble on all fronts of farming right now, regardless. But certainly there's a marketplace out there, I think, with many people, how they feel in their own personal choices of health. You're going to have a marketplace for people that want organic-only products. And certainly if that can be expanded, I support it. And again, it runs directly, though, with the consumer. Is the consumer going to buy the product enough to make it a viable, strong industry? So, again, it comes back to grown in Minnesota, I guess.
All right, let's go to a question. Let's head on down to Worthington for that.
Hi, my name is Steve Reich. I'm a farmer from Wilmot. I farm with my dad and my two brothers, and we raise livestock. Corn and soybeans and cattle and hogs mainly. My first comment would be, before you break up the packers and the other people who buy my product, make sure I have some place to sell it to before you do that.
Yeah.
And the next thing is, you know, as been mentioned many times, we're an older group of farmers now. Like, I'm 40 and I've been farming for 20 years, and in my township there's not too many guys that are younger than that. And a lot of the farms are ready to be passed on to the next generation. Those farms have been paid for once, twice, sometimes three times already. When my dad dies, we're going to have to pay for it again, and there's lots of people in that situation. I think one of the ways to keep somebody on the farm is to make it possible to pass that farm on without taxing us to death again. As we in the Cattlemen's Association, we call it a death tax. You know, what a terrible way to have to buy your farm back.
So,
go ahead.
So, in other words, getting away from any type of inheritance tax, is that what you're telling me?
Well, it's extremely high.
I've never liked it anyway. I've never figured out why there is one to begin with.
In
anywhere in the world, why is there an inheritance tax? If your parents paid for something and bought it and they want to leave it to you, I don't see what business it is of the government to be involved at all. And I speak only over the fact I've lost both of my parents, so I went through it already and scratched what little hair on my head off, trying to figure out where the heck this tax came from. No, I don't think there should be inheritance taxes at all if you're leaving it to a direct descendant, regardless of where you live, whether it's a home in the city or a farm out in greater Minnesota.
Next session.
That's one I'm, thank you.
That's a question.
We'll start looking at it.
The point the governor raised about the farm cabinet, and it's the idea of bringing in the commissioners from all the different agencies that have something to do with agriculture. One of our first challenges, first assignments, is to see where does Minnesota fit competitively with the other states as it relates to some of these issues. Revenue is included on that for that very reason, looking at some of these tax implications that affect farmers in ways that could be a real detriment. If, in fact, we can't get the prices up where we would like them to be, or as quickly as we'd like them to be, what things can the state be doing to help our input costs or the other side so as not to be such a burden?
All right, we got 5 minutes to go. Let's get up to Crookston one more time. Crookston.
It's Ben Kleinbach, Marshall County Commissioner. Our county is heavily reliant on ag. And we're wondering about infrastructure things and property taxes. But the question is this a temporary cycle then that we can look forward to, that I'm going to go out and tell our people that get used to this for the long haul, and our ag policies, both state and federal, designed to keep the low prices and that sort of thing?
I certainly hope not. I mean, part of the problem has been the Asian marketplace. You know, we got into bad timing, for lack of better terminology. We had tremendous growing seasons here. The farmers were extremely productive at the time when the whole Asian markets went down the toilet, for a lack of a better terminology. And it was bad timing on both sides on that issue, because we export so much of our ag products worldwide now that when a market over in Asia falters and falls, it's going to have create an extreme problem back here in Minnesota.
Commissioner, I've heard one person, ag expert, say that he expects low prices to continue for 2 to 5 years. Do you share that bleak viewpoint?
Well, Secretary of Agriculture Glickman has just about a week ago was made a comment that thinks that the Asian economy has bottomed out, and so that it's a question now, how quickly does something like this come back? I think for a state like Minnesota, our chore or our challenge then is to look at what can we do to speed our participation in any kind of recovery. That's part of the reason why the governor is taking a group to Japan this fall, to look at what are the things that we could be doing to, as it relates even to agriculture, to be in on the ground floor of some of that recovery.
3 minutes to go. We have another question from Lori Sturtevant.
Hi, I'm Julie Swanson from Lesueur, Minnesota, and I'm a member of a third-generation beekeeping family. And we think agriculture, they always think till the land. There's a lot of specialties. I think that to help solve this problem, meaning we're not going to get it done here, there should be someone maybe from the governor's office sent to each state organization's meetings, such as the beekeepers, the dairy producers and stuff, and go to these grassroots meetings and get some ideas from these people that don't get out to these meetings, that sit back and sit and complain. And if you sit them at their meetings, you're going to hear these things.
You can also write us, too. We'll be happy to listen.
All right, very good. Do we have another question from, say, Worthington? Anybody lined up there? We've got about 2 minutes to go. Nope, well, we only got a couple of minutes to go, so we're almost out of time. Very quickly, Commissioner Hugesson, you and the federal government have been in somewhat of a spat over the Conservation Reserve Program. That's the program that farmers can take land out of production that's environmentally sensitive. Federal government will pay for them. You put a cap in on a per-county basis as to how many farmers could get it. So some farmers are squeezed out. A lot of people unhappy with that, including Tracy Beckman here.
I didn't put a cap on. I mean, as a state official, I have no control over what the federal government can or cannot do. They asked me for my opinion. I gave the opinion that to do that for 10 years potentially creates some real problems. What I think we ought to be doing instead is looking at some kind of a program of a 3 to 5 year duration that could address some of the issues as it relates to wheat scab, some of the disease problems that exist up in that area. If in fact you tie up some of that additional land going beyond the 25% that's there right now, we literally are going to
25% of all the land in that county.
In that county. Okay. I mean, that's the cap right now that could go into CRP, and that's where those counties were. So if in fact we, you know, look at ratcheting that up real higher for a long period of time, we literally are going to close down main streets in some of these communities. The other thing that I find real interesting is that in a lot of those communities, the people that would be getting this money don't live in that community. They are outside people. They live in Arizona. They live in it. One of the first calls we got was from Eden Prairie that was not happy with what I said.
Tracy Beckman, half a minute to go. 3 to 5 years, that's
well,
like a reasonable compromise?
You know, there are times when you disagree, and here was an opportunity to get some dollars directly into an economy that is in tough, tough shape and appears to not have the prospects of turning around. And I just think that would have been a time where we all get together and say, hey, we got a chance to get some dollars here. Let's get them. And we can plug them right into those communities. So it was just a disagreement on.
But let's target it to those that need it, just like our farm package this year. It was an across the board. You've got wealthy farms. Believe me, they're out there.
I didn't
There's wealthy farms out there, and yet they got subsidized too.
You're absolutely right.
And that
right,
was
Governor.
Not Governor Ventura's thought. Governor Ventura was targeting. But the legislature decided to go across the board.
As is fitting, the governor gets the last word. Governor, thank you very much. That is all the time we have for tonight.
We do want to make sure that you know about the second in our series of agriculture discussions. It's tentatively scheduled for Thursday, July 15th. Listen to Minnesota Public Radio, watch public TV for further details.
And if you want to know more about anything we talked about tonight, each of tonight's sponsoring groups has plenty of information online. You can find it by going to startribune.com, npr.org, or ktca.org.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope to see you again very soon. Special thanks to all the county extension agents, about 50 of them, who helped make tonight's program happen. To all of them and all of you, thanks for watching. Good night.
Tonight Minnesota is made possible in part with support from the Blandon Foundation, creating a stronger Minnesota by bridging rural and urban communities. The McKnight Foundation, dedicated to improving the quality of life for Minnesota families. And by Koch Petroleum Group, we're fueling a clean future. Diversity Unit reporting on Newsnight Minnesota is provided by the J. and Rose Phillips Family Foundation, promoting good relations among all races and religions.